and she resolved to face down Archer Campbell. She put her arm straight out, her fisted hand against his shoulder, and pushed him away. "Mr. Campbell," she said, "you are inappropriate." His hand closed over her forearm. She spun around and jerked free in one motion, and they stood looking at each other. She could hear her heartbeat echoing in her ears, and every nerve was twanging like a fire bell.
"You will talk to me."
His voice went husky, and she saw his pupils dilating with an almost sexual response to her rejection. She thought of one quick jerk of the knee and how that would take the look off his face.
"I want to know where Mabel Stone is," he said. "Don't tell me you don't know what I'm talking about. I saw you go into her place that night with the detectives, and the next day the Stones were gone, both of them. There's no word of them, and nobody knows where they went. Except you. You know, don't you?"
Anna looked him directly in the eye for a count of three. She said, "Mr. Campbell, leave this building and never come back. Never approach me again, or I will swear out a complaint."
"Haven't answered my question, though, have you? That's as good as a confession in my book. You'll talk to me, unless you like the idea of a search. You'll never know when it's coming, but I can guarantee you Comstock will find what he needs to send you to prison."
In some part of her brain, Anna realized that he didn't know she was married, or to whom. The thought made her smile, and her smile made his whole face contort with rage. This is what his wife faced every day, she thought. This is what she lived with for years. A small group of people came into the hall. An orderly, too busy flirting with the nursing students to take notice of anything else, and behind them, Elise. She pushed her way through the others and broke into a trot.
"Dr. Savard," she called. "Do you need help?"
"She does,"
said Campbell with a wide rictus of a smile that displayed graying teeth.
"But not from you."
His eyes moved over Anna, roaming over her body to stop on her face.
"You're no woman a man would want as a wife. I doubt you even know you are a woman."
His grin flickered on and off.
"But then old maids can be surprising. All those juices stored up with no place to go."
There was a distinct buzzing in her ears, and she seemed to be watching the scene from a remove. She felt no fear or even disgust. The most she could muster was a clinical interest, wondering what an alienist would make of Campbell.
"I could show you what goes on in a man's bed."
Then Elise Mercier stepped forward with both fists raised and delivered a blow to Campbell's middle that deflated him like a pin to a hot air balloon. All the breath in his lungs left him in a rush, the smell of oysters and ale hanging in the air as he collapsed to the floor, hacking and fighting for air. It all happened in seconds, and then everyone was staring at Elise. The look on the orderly's face was distinctly admiring, but the nurses were shocked and, Anna thought, a little frightened. Elise studied Campbell, writhing on the ground and gasping for air.
"He'll be all right. More's the pity," she said to no one in particular.
Then she realized that everyone was looking at her, and she produced a small, crooked smile. She said,
"Six brothers."
That seemed to satisfy them all. The orderly crouched down to get hold of Campbell by the collar of his jacket and yanked him to his feet.
"Would you be wanting to call the police, Dr. Savard?"
Anna shook her head. "Just put him out on the street, please, Jeremy. I need to get to surgery. Nurse Mercier, I suggest you soak that hand in cold water before it begins to swell." But she smiled at Elise. "Later, I'll try to remember to remind you about the prohibition on violence inside the New Amsterdam." Elise, soaking her hand, was still angry enough to spit. But she was also deeply apprehensive. Bullies did not stand down so easily, especially not when they had been bested by a girl. Walking home from the New Amsterdam might not be the best idea, not for herself or Anna. She wondered why Anna had not sent for the police, if there was something unspoken that stopped her. After a while, she dried her hand, flexing each finger and making a fist. No serious damage. But then, punching Campbell's middle had been like burying her fist in half-risen bread dough. She thought for a long moment, and then went to find pen and paper. Jack had come to the conclusion that the one advantage to working the night shift was Mrs. Cabot's determination to feed him to bursting when he got up in the early afternoon. Today he was served a spicy beef hash, along with a wedge of onion pie, a dish of preserved green peas dressed with mint and cream, and a bowl of banana pudding. When he protested, she poured him more coffee and put another slice of onion pie on his plate. Then she went off to answer a knock at the door and came back with a note.
Dear Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte, I write to say that this morning a man called Archer Campbell came to the hospital and spoke very rudely to Dr. Savard in the hall outside our office. Very rudely. Because I feared for her safety, I stepped in and delivered a shovel hook as taught to me by my brothers. I intended this for his liver, but it landed on his diaphragm instead. He was not seriously hurt, but he may swear out a complaint against me. More disturbing, I fear he may also seek revenge toward Dr. Savard or me or both of us, and thus this note. To be clear, I didn't hear the conversation between them, and I don't know what it was he wanted, but he wanted it very badly. Yours sincerely, Elise Mercier.
His first stop was the New Amsterdam, where he found Joshua Abernathy behind the porter's desk. Dr. Savard didn't want us to call in the police, he told Jack. I would have done it anyway, but I figured you'd be along. He didn't have much to report beyond the fact that Campbell had snuck in while the porter's shift was changing, at about 6. I didn't see him come in, but I made sure to see him out. The surly expression gave way to a wide smile. He was still coughing and wheezing. I hear Nurse Mercier walloped him proper, right in the bread basket. She sent me a note, worried about Campbell hanging around, looking for a chance to get his own back. Same thought occurred to me, said the porter. If you hadn't shown your face by 4, I would have sent a note on my own. Has he been hanging around? Not that I could see. But there's no shortage of dark corners to hide in, if he's determined. And that was the question. Jack could imagine Campbell desperate and foolish enough to do about anything. From the New Amsterdam, he went straight to Oscar's boarding house on Grove Street. It was a big, comfortable, and orderly house, where troublemakers didn't last a week, because Oscar saw to it. For his help, the landlady gave him use of the parlor, where Jack found him with a newspaper and a cigar in a sea of smoke. He sat down across from him and handed over Elise's note.
Oh-ho!
Oscar put the paper down and read. Jack said, How close are you to sorting out the last of the bonds? Oscar had taken the bonds on as a project, converting them to cash at different banks a few at a time, and sending the money to Little Compton by registered messenger. The scheme was both elaborate and fraught with pitfalls, but Oscar lived for that kind of challenge.
Just 3 left, he told Jack now. Not too many or too few. Just right. I'm looking forward to this.
When they sat down to dinner at Aunt Quinlan's table for the first time in almost a week, Anna was prepared to be asked a million questions about everything from Staten Island to Mrs. Cabot's magical head cold tea. Instead, there was only one subject under discussion, the upcoming trip to Greenwood. The Mezzanotte family celebrated the 24th of June every year with a huge party, and the combined Quinlan and Savard households were invited to join them. Margaret had other plans she couldn't change, but the other adults were almost as excited as the little girls to be getting out of the city. Even the Lees were coming. Jack had announced his plan to show Mr. Lee around the farm and greenhouses right from the start, which put Anna in a difficult spot. She tried to explain the problem.
Mr. Lee never leaves Waverly Place except to visit their son and his family, and he's just 4 blocks away. He always has the same excuse, that somebody has to stay to look after the property. Properties now.
But Jack had gotten a particular look, one she had learned to recognize as unvoiced disagreement. The next day, he introduced a young patrol officer he liked and trusted to the Lees. With their approval, Jack hired him to stand watch while they were gone. Mrs. Lee was so touched that for once, she couldn't find a single thing to say. But Aunt Quinlan didn't hesitate. She pulled him down to kiss one cheek while she patted the other. Anna wondered why they had never thought to do something similar in the past. So they were going to Greenwood. Anna knew they had put the visit off too long already, and that nothing short of an earthquake would be an acceptable excuse for staying away. What she couldn't explain to herself was how nervous the whole thing made her, until Aunt Quinlan pointed out that a big party with a lot of people would be easier than a small supper where she had everyone's attention.
"We need to get an anniversary gift," Aunt Quinlan said now. "How many years have your parents been married, Jack?"
He stared at the ceiling while he subtracted. "Massimo was born on the 24th of June in..." He looked at his niece, who was waiting for this question.
1844.
So they were married on the same day in 1843. That would be 40 years ago.
"They don't want presents," Chiara added. "We don't give a lot of presents."
She said this a little wistfully. Anna was thinking about 40 years of marriage. What that might be like in the year 1933. If there would be children and grandchildren and a party. She thought sometimes about children, a subject Jack hadn't yet raised in any serious way. Why that might be was unclear, and not something she wanted to contemplate just now.
"What are you thinking about?" Rosa asked her. "Your face is all scrunched together."
Anna started out of her thoughts. "I was thinking that I'd like more of that apple cobbler, unless somebody else has beaten me to it."
"Your appetite is restored," her Aunt Quinlan said.
"After days of toast and tea and clear broth, I could eat the tablecloth."
The girls found this very funny, as if they hadn't had the same diet for days. Margaret said,
"What time are you leaving on Sunday?"
The discussion shifted to the logistic challenge of getting them all to the Hoboken Ferry in time. They were a party of, the girls counted on their fingers, noisily, and came up with the astonishing number of 10, counting Bambina and Celestina, 11 if Ned came too, as the little girls were hoping. The plan was to leave Sunday morning and return to Manhattan late on Monday.
"Are there beds for all of us?"
Aunt Quinlan asked again.
"Yes," Chiara said, smiling broadly. "Room enough."
Rosa was asking Chiara about the Mezzanotte grandchildren. She wanted names and ages, and maybe even a chart that would tell her who got along and who didn't. It seemed now that Rosa had survived the trip to Mount Loretto and the shock of losing Vittorio. She had always been a serious child, and now just enough of that had lifted to see what might become of her if she could learn to let her brothers go. She wasn't healing, that was the wrong word. She was coming to terms with loss, as Anna had never been able to do. Sleepless, restless, images and snatches of conversation tumbling through her head, Anna decided that she would go read in the parlor. In the day, the room was sunny, but there were gas lights and a good chair and a rug to put over her legs if the room was chilly. Though Jack was a deep sleeper, she moved very quietly, swung her legs over the side of the bed, and sat up.
Savard.
She lay back down again. He rolled to his side and yawned at her. The curtains weren't closed all the way, so that she could just make out his features by the faint light from the street lamp.
I didn't mean to wake you.
Why not?
Because you need your sleep.
So do you.
He ran a hand down her arm.
The tension is rising off you in waves.
I'm going to go read until I'm too tired to stay awake.
Not yet, he said. Just rest next to me.
His hand traveled up and down her arm, the lightest of touches. She said,
I don't want to talk about that dream.
He hummed at her, his broad fingertips barely brushing along her skin. When she was about to say that it was no use, she would go read in the parlor, he made a soft shushing sound.
I have a question that isn't about your brother, and I want you to think about it before you answer.
She drew in a deep breath.
All right.
Why did you feel so drawn to Rosa as soon as you met her?
Others had asked her this question, but she had never answered it truthfully because she knew this much. She didn't know the answer. She thought back to that day in the church basement in Hoboken, all the frightened and anxious and angry children, and Rosa holding on with all her strength to her brothers and sisters, as if they were all that kept her afloat. She was going to find her father. She had promised her mother. She would keep the family together come what may. Anna had listened closely and watched her face, knowing that none of those things would happen. They were orphans and Italian, and they were about to be tossed into a whirlwind. She said,
I was that determined too, once upon a time.
When the telegram came saying Paul had been wounded in battle, I tried to run away. I thought that if I could get to Virginia and find him in the army hospital, he would get better.
How far did you get?
Not very.
Uncle Quinlan caught up with me at the corner, on my way to the omnibus. I was 6 years old. I screamed and kicked and bit, but he never scolded me. He just carried me home to Aunt Quinlan, and they sat with me while I howled. That evening, Uncle Quinlan left for Virginia. Later, Auntie told me he would have gone under any circumstances. But I still think that he went for me. The irony is that Paul was dead before Uncle Quinlan got there. But there was no way he could have known that, and so he went around the field hospitals, asking. That's how he caught typhus. He died not 2 days later, and they both came home in coffins.
Jack seemed to hesitate. You blame yourself for your uncle's death.
She turned on her side to look at this man who was her husband.
I blame Paul.
I blame Paul because when our parents died, he swore he would always take care of me and never leave me. That when he grew up, he'd have a house and we could live there together. And just 3 years later, he broke his word and went to war. He was the most important person in my world. He knew that. But he left me to go to war when he promised he wouldn't. And he died when he said he wouldn't. And he took Uncle Quinlan with him. Uncle Quinlan was the only father I remembered. Everyone thinks that I was mourning my brother, that I'm still mourning him. But that's not true. I was consumed with anger. I couldn't say his name. I didn't want to see his likeness. I hated him for leaving me. And I couldn't say that. Not to anyone. Not even to Aunt Quinlan. It was unsaid until Sophie came. But she understood without words. All these years, people tiptoe around me when the subject of my brother comes up. It's almost funny sometimes.
And the thing is, I've tried to stop, but I can't feel any other way.
She drew in a breath like a hiccup and turned away to lay an arm over her eyes. Her whole body was shaking, but she was powerless to do anything but let it happen. She was afraid to look at Jack, sure to see disappointment and disapproval where there had been no doubt. Jack made himself take 3 deep breaths and reached for her. She came to him, trembling, pressed her face against his shoulder, and wept. When she was quiet, he said, "I don't know if it would be any comfort to me if I were in your place, but I can guarantee that your brother died thinking of you and full of regrets."
"You were so young, Anna." "He was young, too, but old enough to know that he had failed you. He made promises he couldn't keep because he thought that would make you happy."
She swallowed hard. "All these years I was so angry at him, so unforgiving. And then I went and did the same thing to Rosa that he did to me."
Jack sat up, pulling her with him, holding on to her shoulders so he could look into her face, tear-streaked and swollen. "You are too rational a person to really believe that. You promised to look for the boys, and you've done that. You're still doing that. Rosa doesn't hate you. Anna, Rosa and Leah will love you for as long as they live."
He pressed his mouth to her temple.
"And so will I."
Chapter 43. Rosa came to breakfast on Friday morning without Leah. She stood very formally before Anna, her expression almost sorrowful as she put a folded piece of paper on the table.
"Will you read this, please?"
Anna could feel Jack watching them, but she kept her gaze focused on Rosa.
"Now?"
Rosa nodded, the muscles in her throat working hard as she swallowed. Anna spread the single sheet open. Rosa had written from margin to margin, each letter carefully formed and spaced.
"Dear Mayor of Annandale, Staten Island, New York, I write to ask whether you have living in your town Eamon and Helen Mullen and their 2 children, a girl and a baby boy. Mr. Mullen is a blacksmith. If you know of them, I would very much like to learn their address in order to write them a letter. Thank you. Yours sincerely, Rosa Russo, 18 Waverly Place, New York, New York."
Anna finished reading and handed the sheet of paper to Jack. Rosa was staring at the floor, her head bent. She was trying so hard to be a grown-up. It wouldn't do for Anna to start crying.
"Rosa?"
The small face came up slowly. Misery and determination fought for the upper hand. Anna said,
"You'll need a 3-cent postage stamp. I've got some in my desk."
After some discussion, they came up with a plan. Every week, Rosa would write to another town, one she chose from the atlas she found in the parlor bookcases at Rose's. One week, she would write to a town in New York, the next in New Jersey. Anna would provide the paper, envelope, and postage stamp. Margaret would help her with the wording, consulting now and then with Aunt Quinlan and the others. Rosa would continue writing these letters for as long as she liked. Rosa asked Jack a question that another man would have had trouble answering.
"Do you think I might find them this way?"
He reached out and put a hand on the crown of her head.
"I've seen stranger things happen."
Elise came in as Rosa left.
"I'm about to leave for the hospital," Anna said. "If you want to walk with me, you should get your things."
"I will," she said, "but I wanted to be sure you saw this."
She put the New York Post on the table in front of Anna, and Jack immediately got up to come around and read over her shoulder. New York Post, late edition. Archer Campbell in custody.
stolen bearer bonds found in his possession. Acting on an anonymous tip, Detective Sergeants H.A. Sainsbury and M.P. Larkin of the New York Police Department yesterday searched the home of Archer Campbell at 19 Charles Street and found a number of stolen bearer bonds. Campbell resisted arrest and sustained significant injuries in his struggle with the detectives. He sits now in the Tombs, awaiting arraignment. Just weeks ago, Campbell appeared in court to testify in the inquest into his wife's sudden and tragic death. At the same time, the couple's four young sons disappeared without a trace and are still missing. The city mourned with Mr. Campbell for the loss of his family, only to find that their sympathy was ill-placed. The bonds found in his possession were just three of a larger issue of 50. The Boston and New York police will interrogate Campbell in an attempt to uncover the location of the rest of the bonds. The Boston police tell us this was an older robbery, Detective Sergeant Larkin told the Post. It's possible the rest of the bonds will never be recovered.
It took a great deal of stern self-discipline, but Elise never asked about the newspaper article. She kept all her questions to herself and ignored the burn of curiosity in her throat. Instead, they talked about Regina Sartori's surgery, which Anna had missed. To Elise, Anna's many questions felt something like an exam that she hadn't studied for, but she answered with what turned out to be satisfactory detail. Finally, she got up the nerve to ask about a different matter, almost as difficult as the newspaper article. Has there been any progress in the post-mortem cases we talked about?
Anna glanced at her in surprise, as if she had already forgotten the long conversation of just 2 days ago. Then her expression cleared.
There's been another case, she said, and a little forward movement. A witness who has some information the detectives are pursuing. Did you find the cases interesting? The circumstances are terrible, but the discussion was interesting. Did the detectives agree that the doctor must be well-established and considered trustworthy? At that, Anna smiled. Just the opposite. They have a suspect, an intern, very young and untried. I'm not sure why exactly, but they are as sure about him as I am convinced that you have the right of it, and they should be looking for someone older.
They walked in silence for a while,
and then Elise said what came to mind. Why couldn't it be both?
On the way out of the squad room, a runner brought Jack a message that he opened and read on the spot. Oscar waited, worrying the end of his cigar. Well? From Anna. It says, why are you assuming there is only one doctor? Could it not be the man you suspect, as well as a more established physician, the two working together? Elise suggested this to me, and it makes sense. I can see where this is going, Oscar said dismally. Those two are after our jobs.
This time they found Neil Graham's landlady up to her elbows in soap suds. But she was all good cheer, made offers of tea and cake, begged just a moment while she changed her apron. When she had finally settled on the very edge of a sofa, Oscar smiled at her.
Mrs. Jennings, we are just trying to tie up some loose ends on a case, and we were wondering if you might answer a few questions for us.
She had the bright dark eyes of a robin, but the way she was chewing on her lower lip gave her nervousness away. Well, now, she said, her hands fluttering. You know I'm not the youngest anymore, and my memory sometimes fails me.
Jack caught on before Oscar. He introduced them both and left all details about their last visit unstated.
It seemed possible that Mrs. Jennings had no memory of their earlier meeting. Anna wondered if that would work for or against them. Mrs. Jennings seemed relieved not to be scolded, and sat up even straighter, an eager school child wanting to please the teacher.
We have a few questions about one of your boarders, Neil Graham. We are trying to locate his family, but without luck. Do you happen to know where they live?
Vague enough, he hoped, to start her talking. She nodded her hands in her lap.
Oh, she said, Neil Graham, a very good boy, very orderly, never late with his rent, never tries to sneak girls into his room, which you must imagine happens often with young men like these medical students. The things I've seen. I could make the Seven Sisters blush, I'm sure of it.
She paused as if she had lost track of the subject.
Neil Graham, Oscar said gently.
Oh, yes, Dr. Graham.
No, he never has girls in his room, or I've never caught him at it, I should say.
Young men do have their urges. But he's never been in any trouble.
Do you know if he has any family nearby, or any close friends who might come to visit?
Oscar leaned back, as relaxed as a Buddha, radiating calm acceptance of whatever she wanted to tell them. It was the only hope they had of getting anything useful from the conversation.
Family, family.
A sister, I think. Or a brother. A brother-in-law.
Yes, a married sister. She comes by now and then and brings him things, new shirts and socks and such.
He never seems very happy to see her, but then brothers and sisters often quarrel. She was a very elegant type, tall and slim, but no furs or jewels. Spoke to me very politely, and didn't even blink when her brother was short with her.
And her name? The small dark eyes opened wide.
Sure, she has one. I don't recall what it was he called her. She came in a fine carriage.
You don't have any idea of her family name?
Well, Graham, of course.
Pardon me, Mrs. Jennings, but didn't you just say she was married? Did her husband come to call with her?
He waited out in the carriage.
Did you catch the brother-in-law's last name?
No, I don't think I did. Shall I ask Dr. Graham when he comes in?
It's really not important, Oscar said. No reason to bother Dr. Graham with it. If you happen to remember anything else about his sister, would you drop us a note at police headquarters? We'll come again if you recall something new.
He fished a card out of his vest pocket and passed it over to her.
I'll try, but my memory does sometimes fail me. Oh, Dr. Graham's sister might be a baker's wife. She smelled of anise. Might that be of use?
It might just, Oscar said.
On the porch, Oscar shook Mrs. Jennings's hand with great formality. As he was turning away, he seemed to remember something. It always amazed Jack that no one ever saw through this little ruse, and came up with one last question.
How often did the older gentleman visit?
Mrs. Jennings smiled apologetically.
I can't say. It wasn't very often, and always on Sunday. Not a talkative man. The kind who don't heap praise on a child, or anybody for that matter.
And his name?
Don't fathers and sons always have the same last name? Dr. Graham, I suppose.
Wait, I'm confused. Neil Graham's father comes to call. Is that right?
Oscar's voice came a little hoarse. A hound on the scent, Jack thought.
Not very often, said the landlady.
And his father is a doctor, like he is. How do you know that he's a doctor?
She nodded eagerly, as if she had finally come across something that might please him.
He carries one of those doctor bags. I've been boarding medical students for many years, and I'd know one of those bags anywhere.
Jack said, she could be wrong on both counts. The old man might not be Graham's father, and even if he is, she could be mistaken by the bag.
No, Oscar said. She had it right.
Except I think the man she remembered was the grandfather she mentioned last time. an older doctor, established, experienced, trustworthy. A woman paying him a visit would be assured by all that. Once she's under, she doesn't know who actually does the operation, does she?
Jack shook his head.
I don't know. It feels too pat, like a big bow on an empty box. Do you have a better idea where to start?
The ultimate argument. When you were stuck, you worked the clues. They spent the rest of the day interviewing clerks at hospitals, clinics, and dispensaries from one end of the island to the other, jumping in and out of cabs until they came across a driver they knew and hired him to drive them for the day. So far, no one had any memory of a Dr. Graham, who met the landlady's description. Getting a hit going about it like this was unlikely, but they plowed on, jerking through traffic from St. Luke's to Women's Hospital. Oscar raised the subject of Archer Campbell.
Does Anna know they booked him?
Jack shook his head.
Oscar said, he doesn't realize how lucky he is to be sitting in the tombs where you can't get at him. He can't make bail, Jack said, so he's safe where he is for the time being. Unless you want to grease old Fish's palm, so we could pay prisoner Campbell a visit. I admit it's tempting, but Anna wouldn't like it.
Oscar stroked his mustache thoughtfully.
All right, he said. We'll table it for the moment.
In the late afternoon, they went back to Mulberry Street with just three names. Michael Graham, house physician at the Protestant half-orphan asylum, Ulrich Graham, on the faculty at the Eclectic Medical School, and Andrew Graham, who had a small practice near Stuyvesant Square. None of them old enough to be Neil Graham's father or grandfather, but they'd have a look anyway. They'd find something to eat and start calling on hospital night porters. Most of them liked to talk. All of them were bored, and they saw a lot. What Jack wanted to do was to go home to Anna, to stay close so she didn't start to imagine that the things she had told him in the night were weighing on him, as if anything could make him think less of her. He wrote her a note, one that he put in an envelope and sealed.
Anna, my love, I'll be very late, but it's your own fault. The suggestion you made earlier today has us rushing around Manhattan looking for that second doctor, and we're making progress. Oscar thinks you're after his job. I ask myself now every day how I got so lucky. Love you, Jay.
All day long, Anna wondered if she had imagined the newspaper article about Archer Campbell, a question that could have been answered by a short trip to the corner where six different daily newspapers could be had for pennies each. She could read the news in German if she pleased, or Italian, or Hebrew. And then, as soon as the opportunity presented itself, she had some very specific questions for Jack and Oscar. But she didn't go get a paper, not so much because she conquered her disquiet, but because she had one emergency after another that kept her in the operating room. It began with a woman whose hand had been caught up in the machinery at a steam cleaner's, mangled and scalded both. There was no choice but to amputate, which meant that she was robbing the woman of her livelihood. She explained this to her husband, still young enough that he had very little beard, and watched his eyes fill with tears that he blinked back furiously. Elise was serving as the circulating nurse that day and was doing a very good job ignoring the stares and whispers that came her way. They were referring to her as the little nun with the hard fist. Apparently, Anna wasn't the only one thinking about Campbell's visit.
I hear you were assaulted in the hall yesterday,
Judith Ambrose said when they were scrubbing in together.
A red-haired demon, the story goes. Nurse Mercier came to your rescue with a very professional 1-2 punch.
Anna had to laugh. She says she was taught how to fight by her brothers.
She's a tough one, all right. Let's see how she handles this sad mess.
The patient was a woman of about 30, a charwoman so strong that it took 3 orderlies to restrain her. She was howling, a terrible, mournful wail that cut right to the bone.
"You can't have my baby."
Her voice was tear-clogged and hoarse.
"You can't. You can't. I won't let you."
Judy Ambrose crouched down so that the patient could see her face.
"Mrs. Allen, listen, please, Mrs. Allen. Your baby is no longer alive. Its heart stopped beating at least a month ago. I'm sorry for your loss, truly sorry, but we have to think of your health now. The medicine we've given you will help you deliver the child. Don't fight it, please. If you don't deliver the child, you'll get very sick and you will die of blood poisoning."
"No, it's not dead."
She strained against the restraints, her whole body arching into a contraction. When it passed, she said,
"I feel it kicking. Just leave it be. Just go away and leave me alone, please."
Anna finished scrubbing in and saw that Elise was watching this exchange very closely. She was biting her lip as if to keep herself from speaking.
"Elise? Just a thought."
"Go on."
"She might be comforted by prayer. If someone prayed with her for the soul of her child, can a priest be called?"
"You don't want to pray with her?" Elise put a hand to her lower face and shook her head sharply. "Then find someone who will," Anna said. "We're about to get started here." Not a half hour after the conclusion to Mrs. Allen's labor, Anna was scrubbing in again, this time for a slack-faced young girl who refused to give a name. Her problem was easily diagnosed. Elise said,
"This seems to be a common ailment."
"Women who are desperate do desperate things," Anna said. "You will see a lot of this, I'm sorry to say."
"I thought I understood about poverty."
"You still don't. You won't, until you start going out with the visiting nurses. That's where many women give up medicine."
"Not men?"
Anna looked at this young woman who showed so much promise, who learned so eagerly and quickly, and who still was completely unprepared for the trials to come. "Primarily women. Few male doctors will visit patients in the worst of the tenements. I don't know of any who treat the outdoor poor unless they come to a clinic. I personally think that all male medical students should be required to pay home visits to the poorest and most desperate for a month at least. But nobody asks my opinion." She managed a small smile. "So let's see to this girl. I think her case will take a happy ending." She stopped herself. "That's entirely the wrong word. What I mean is, we will probably be able to save her life." On the way home, she stopped to buy a variety of newspapers and then sat on a bench in the small cemetery behind St. Mark's to look through them. She found mention of Archer Campbell's arrest in all of them, the articles prominently placed. There was no new information beyond the fact that he had been arrested when 3 stolen bearer bonds were found in his possession. The gossip rags were speculating on his role in the disappearance of his 4 sons. In that, they were entirely wrong, and also absolutely correct. The names of the detectives were familiar, for the simple reason that Jack had introduced her to both Michael Larkin and Hank Sainsbury the last time she had been to police headquarters. They had both been polite and terribly awkward, because, Jack told her later, they had no experience of respectable women in their squad room, and feared the wrath of Maroney if they failed to meet his standards of proper behavior. She thought of Archer Campbell sitting in the Tombs. With his visit to the New Amsterdam, he had crossed a line of no return, in Jack's view of the world. She asked herself if she should be objecting for moral or ethical reasons. Then she thought of Mabel Stone and 4 little boys, and decided she should not. Chapter 44. She said,
"Don't you have a full day planned?"
Jack's arms tightened around her waist.
You owe me a rainy Saturday in bed.
I might debate that if it were raining, but it's not. Jack.
Heartless wretch.
Just a mutter, but she heard it, and she knew without a doubt that he was already asleep again. It was a trick Anna knew, too. She had learned it out of necessity during her training. Somehow, that made it easier to rouse him again. She pressed a hand to his shoulder.
Jack, don't you have to go in?
His eyes opened.
I didn't get in until 3 hours ago.
That late, Anna said. Did you make some progress on the case? He rubbed a hand over his jaw, and the beard stubble made a sound like a scrubbing brush on brickwork.
3 doctors named Graham so far. None of them fit the bill. We talked to maybe 10 night porters. Later today, we'll go to the registry office and have a look through the books.
He yawned and stretched, opened one eye, and waggled both brows at her.
Come here.
Oh, no.
She danced away, grabbing up her robe.
You woke me not once, but twice. Now you must face the consequences.
She slipped out the door and ran, and he came along after her, grumbling, struggling into his robe. In the dining room, she said,
Why are you following me?
Now you're fishing for compliments, he said, and gave another great yawn.
At the table, he showed her the text of the advertisement they were going to run in the newspapers. Anna read it while she buttered her toast. She said,
So the idea is that if you can't stop him right away, you might be able to slow him down?
At this point, we have to warn the public.
Anna reasoned that if this announcement in the newspaper frightened one woman away, it was worth the effort and expense.
But what if it makes him angry? What might that mean? Would it make him strike out more often?
My sense is that it won't make a difference, Jack said. I think he's picking up his pace anyway, and that may mean he's getting sloppy. I've been wondering ever since we interviewed Mamie Winthrop's maid. She gave me the impression that women like Winthrop don't have trouble finding a doctor to solve this particular problem, if the price is right and it can be handled privately. Is that true?
Nobody talks about it, but yes, probably. This is one of those areas where physicians say one thing publicly to protect themselves, but then do what they must in the patient's best interest.
Or for their bank balances.
She nodded stiffly.
There are unscrupulous physicians, as there are unscrupulous bankers and factory owners and police. Can we talk about something else?
Just then, Mrs. Cabot brought in the mail, a letter from Amelie on the very top.
Apparently not, Anna said, and opened it while Jack began to look through the rest of the mail. She said,
She sent a newspaper clipping with a note. We're supposed to go see a woman called Kate Sparrow, who lives on Patchen Place. She's got a market stall where she sells sewing supplies, buttons and ribbons and such. I know her stall, but where is Patchen Place?
Just across from the Jefferson Market, off 10th. What's the clipping?
Her gaze still on the letter, she handed the newspaper article over.
From the Morning News.
He swallowed the last of his coffee and read aloud. Shocking testimony during the Campbell inquest. Lady doctors provide salacious details in a public forum. Outrage in the gallery.
Yesterday, the jury of physicians hearing evidence in the Janine Campbell inquest heard testimony from Dr. Anna Savard and Dr. Sophie Savard-Verhoeven. Questioning of Dr. Savard-Verhoeven was particularly sharp and often accusatory in tone. She may be a lady of unusual intelligence, commented a juror who wishes to remain anonymous, but she is still a woman and a mulatta, and unsuited to the practice of medicine. In questioning Dr. Savard-Verhoeven, Anthony Comstock of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice criticized the deceased behavior
and declared that in pursuing an illegal operation, Mrs. Campbell had reaped the terrible harvest of her sins against the laws of God and man. In the testimony that followed, the jury and gallery heard details of the Campbells' marriage that were so personal in nature that Dr. James Cameron, a retired physician, left the courtroom in an outrage. "Such topics violate all rules of decency," he told reporters outside the tombs. He went on to quote the second book of Timothy, verses 11 through 12. "Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or to exercise authority over a man. Rather, she is to remain quiet." When asked whether his admonition was meant for the deceased Mrs. Campbell or the doctor Sabard, Dr. Cameron said, "Both." Jack said, "She underlined the name of the doctor they quote, James Cameron. In the margin, she wrote, 'He's not dead after all.' What does that mean?"
Anna felt as if she had been struck hard in the stomach.
"Anna, is this the old man who bellowed at the coroner and then stomped out of the courtroom?"
"I think it must be. Do you remember what he looked like?"
Jack shrugged. "Frail, bent, very proper, old-fashioned, walked with a cane."
"Yes," Anna said, "of course. The cane." She looked at him directly and knew that she could not hide the disquiet she was feeling. "I saw him, this Dr. Cameron, just the other day, but I didn't recognize him. It was when I came out of the coffee house across from Jefferson Market." One of his eyebrows peaked, and she knew she had his entire attention.
"Go on."
"He was coming down from the L platform. I suppose I never really looked at him in the courtroom. I was so focused on Sophie on the stand. But he looked at me as if he knew me and didn't like what he knew. I remember now. There was another letter he wrote, to the editor at the Tribune." Jack stood up and walked across the room, and then back again to sit down where he started.
"Tell me what your cousin said about him when you saw her."
Anna closed her eyes to concentrate, and then recounted what she remembered. A man more bent on purifying women's souls than saving their lives. "And she said he was old when she knew him, and was probably dead. He's so frail, Jack. I find it hard to imagine him operating at all. And why would a woman who can afford to pay $300 settle for him? A steady hand is the very least a woman would want."
Jack said, "They had resources, but don't forget that all of the women we know about lacked connections. Some of them were from out of town, others were from overseas, a few were isolated for other reasons. Mrs. Schmidt's husband is a Baptist minister, for example. None of them could go to sisters or cousins or aunts for advice on what doctor to consult. Now I wonder if we wasted a day looking for Neil Graham's father or grandfather. I need to roust Oscar and get moving on this."
He turned back suddenly.
"This Kate Sparrow, she may not want to talk to us without you."
"I could meet you there at noon, unless I have an emergency, and if it won't be too long." He came around the table, leaned down to kiss her cheek.
"Good."
He took a moment to look at her, his eyes moving over her face.
"Sometimes your eyes are brown and gold and green, and sometimes they seem mostly brown, sometimes green. How do you do that?"
She tugged on an earlobe. "It's a secret I dare not divulge." He smiled against her mouth when he kissed her, and then they both went off to get ready for work. The small bit of breakfast Anna had managed to get down lay like a lead weight in her gut. Elise had saved her time off without a specific plan for how to use it, until the trip to Greenwood came up. Even such a short trip, they would be gone overnight, was exciting. On Saturday morning, she woke thinking that she had 3 full days, and committed herself to using the time to best advantage.
She started the day by airing bedding, changing sheets, sweeping and dusting and polishing her way through all the bedrooms. Mrs. Lee came marching upstairs, wanting to know if Elise was trying to put her granddaughter out of a job, or if she was just set on working herself to death.
"Let me," Elise said. "Please let me. There's enough to keep Laura Lee busy."
Mrs. Quinlan steadfastly refused to accept any payment for room and lodging, but Elise needed to contribute in some way for her own peace of mind.
"Save your money," the old aunt had said when Elise offered to help with household chores. "You'll have expenses in medical school, even with a scholarship."
Today, while she worked, Rosa followed her around, helping but mostly asking questions. Because, she pointed out, Elise knew more about the Catholic Church than anyone else in the house, which Elise herself had to admit was true. So she answered questions about the church hierarchy, about the Pope and the archbishops and bishops and priests. Rosa wanted to know about nuns, and who was the boss of nuns, and if nuns and priests had to go to confession, and what if a priest or nun did something really bad? Nothing Elise said seemed to satisfy her. The little girl wanted justice, and Elise could give her no such promise. After lunch, when the girls went upstairs for their naps, she raised the subject with Mrs. Quinlan.
"She trusts you," Anna's aunt said. "Did you find her questions distressing?"
Elise thought for a moment.
"I wouldn't say her questions distress me. It's just that I left that life behind. Or I'm trying to. Not because I hold a grudge, as everyone seems to think. I have no grounds to be critical of the church."
Margaret pressed her lips together hard, trying not to say what she thought of the Catholic Church, but sending the message anyway.
"I have no personal grounds," Elise amended. "That doesn't mean I don't see that harm has been done, is still being done to others, to Rosa. She wants me to be as angry as she is."
"Maybe you should be," Margaret said. "Maybe you will be, as time passes and you think things through."
"Maybe that's true," Elise said, hearing the strain in her own voice. "Maybe I will feel that way someday. But right now, I don't have the time or the inclination to put the church on trial. I need every bit of energy I can muster for the challenges ahead of me."
After lunch, Elise put Margaret and Rosa and the church out of her head and settled down with her books and notes. There was an elderly woman at the New Amsterdam whose heart was failing, and she needed to understand more about what was happening to her. Anna's copy of Descriptive and Surgical Anatomy was well used, the binding loose and the covers a little warped. A whole army of paper strips populated the pages, each with notes written in a small version of Anna's hand. She took the heavy book on her lap, and it fell open of its own accord to page 570, the lymphatic system of the thorax, to reveal a spray of rosebuds that had been pressed there for safekeeping. In the first moment, she had the odd but undeniable sense that she had opened someone else's love letter. Then she reminded herself that Anna had given her leave to make full use of her medical library, and so allowed herself to study the rosebuds, small and just partially open. Their scent lingered, faintly musky sweet. The pages of the book itself were protected by tissue paper on one side, and on the other a large card of thick cream-colored paper. Without disturbing anything, she could make out some of the printing, an invitation to a masked ball. 100 questions presented themselves, when and where, and mostly why. Anna Savard didn't seem to have any interest in high society, but she had attended this masked ball. Anna and Jack at a fancy ball was such an odd idea that she had to smile. It felt like a love letter, Elise realized now, because it was a kind of wordless declaration. Anna Savard, who presented herself to the world as an educated woman with no need for or interest in frivolities, was also a young woman who pressed flowers for sentimental reasons. She could be both people at once, and that very thought made Elise understand something she had been blind to. As a little girl, she had never seen people courting or falling in love, and in the convent, she had been taught to think of such things as shallow and unnecessary in a purposeful life. But there was something here in these few pressed flowers that spoke very powerfully to the contrary, and in a way that surprised her. She laughed at herself, falling in love with the idea of love, and still, she spent a long time studying the rosebuds before she remembered what she was about and turned to an illustration of the chambers of the human heart. Patchin Place was a narrow lane that opened off 10th Street, lined with cottages leaning together like crooked teeth. As soon as Anna turned into the lane, a plump little woman popped out of a doorway and gestured them closer.
"There you are," she said. "Amelie's cousin Anna the doctor, is that right? I had a letter from her saying you were to drop by, and with two detective sergeants, as big as houses, both of you. Hope I've got enough food."
"Mrs. Sparrow," Anna said, "I'm very glad to meet you, but you really don't need to feed us."
Behind her, Oscar cleared his throat.
"Nonsense," said Kate Sparrow, ushering them in. "My Mary has got charge of the stall for a couple hours, so I had time to cook. I like to feed people. I was just tickled pink to get a letter from Amelie. The least I can do is feed you after all the good service she did me over the years."
When she had arranged them around her table to her satisfaction, Mrs. Sparrow set a huge pot on a trivet between them, added a basket of bread and a jug, ale by the smell, and passed around thick crockery bowls and spoons.
"Now eat," she said, "and I'll talk. Just set me off in the right direction. Amelie said you wanted to know about old Dr. Cameron, is that right?"
Oscar seemed to be struck dumb by the scent from the stew pot, so Jack spoke up.
"That's right. We're just trying to track down background information. Anything you can tell us."
Anna said,
"Amelie thought he had died some time ago."
"And well, he should be dead," said Kate Sparrow. 83, by my reckoning, and so frail a breeze could put him off his feet. Now, I'll get to that, but first I want to hear about Amelie. She didn't say much in her letter but that you would be coming to call."
While Jack and Oscar concentrated on Kate Sparrow's lamb stew, Anna talked about her cousin. The storyteller's price must be paid.
"Amelie told me once she learned midwifery from her own mother, way up north in the mountains when she was a girl,"
Anna said. "Her mother was my great-aunt Hannah. They both attended my mother when I was born."
"Mrs. Sparrow?" "Kate! You must call me Kate."
"Kate, Amelie said you could tell the detective sergeants about a Dr. Cameron." Kate's expression sobered.
"I can tell you about Cameron, if you really want to know."
"We need to know," Jack said.
She spread her hands flat on the table and studied them for a moment.
"The word that comes to mind is severe. Old Testament severe. Quoted the Bible to women in travail. Wanted to hear them pray out loud. Now, to be fair, he knew what he was doing. Rarely lost a mother. But the man never smiles. Not even after he's put a healthy baby in its ma's arms."
"Did he ever strike out? Was he violent?"
Oscar asked.
"You mean with fists? I don't think so. The man has a temper, but it was all talk. Fire and brimstone. A girl expecting a baby without a husband, you could hear him shouting down on the street if the windows were open."
"He's still in practice, delivering babies."
Anna heard her tone and wished she were better at hiding what she was thinking,
But Kate Sparrow didn't seem to notice one way or the other.
"Don't see how he could," she said. "Weak as a kitten. But he goes in and out of that old office of his pretty much every day."
When Oscar asked for more specific information about Cameron's office, Kate Sparrow led them out onto the street. And from the corner, she pointed out a building at the intersection of 10th and Greenwich.
"Second floor," she said. "Side entrance."
They went back to their lunch, and Jack started where Oscar had left off.
"Do you see women coming and going as well? Women who might be patients?"
She shrugged.
"It's a busy corner, and he's not the only one with an office on the second floor. I do see his granddaughter because she takes him lunch every day. I notice her crossing 6th Avenue because she's always lost in her thoughts, and many times she's come close to getting herself run over. It's almost funny the way she looks up and scowls at the driver like he was in her way. But now that I think on it..."
Anna gave her an encouraging smile.
"Nora hasn't passed by for 2 days at least. Maybe he's laid up."
Oscar said, "So Cameron has a granddaughter?"
"Nora Smithson," Kate said. "A beauty, tall and slim, with hair like corn silk. She married the oldest Smithson boy just last year. She used to work with her grandfather, but now she clerks in the apothecary, does Mrs. Smithson, as she's called nowadays, and don't nobody dare forget and call her Nora. The whole family's like that."
She wrinkled her nose as if she were smelling something unpleasant. And that made sense to Anna. She remembered Nora Smithson's condescending and judgmental manner all too clearly. Anna glanced at Jack.
"Could I have a couple of minutes alone with Mrs. Sparrow, do you think?"
When the men had shut the door behind themselves, Kate Sparrow grinned widely.
"I was hoping you'd send them away. Can't really talk about some things, not with men thinking so loud in the background."
Anna managed a smile. "My feelings exactly. So if I can be blunt..." Kate leaned forward, nodding. Oscar bought a paper cone of peanuts, and they walked over to the corner to look at the office building Kate Sparrow had pointed out. Like most of the buildings in the neighborhood, it had seen better days. Rain and weather had scoured most of the paint from the boards, and the roof sagged. But on the ground floor, a cobbler, a leather goods shop, and a confectioner were doing brisk business. Every window in the top two floors advertised a business in bold black paint on glass. Dentist, bookkeeper, sign painter, textile importer, employment agent, dressmaker. It wasn't until they rounded the corner onto Christopher Street that they found what they were looking for. Another entry. And above it, a window identifying the offices of Dr. J.M. Cameron on the second floor. They were debating whether to go up and have a look, when the door opened and a woman came out. Slender and fairly tall, carefully groomed and dressed, a fringe of almost white blonde hair just visible under the brim of her bonnet. Oscar tilted his head toward her and took off in pursuit, leaving Jack to finagle his way into the doctor's office on his own. He went up the stairs at a trot and walked along a dim hall until he stood in front of Cameron's office at the far end. He knocked, waited two beats, tried the knob and found it unlocked, and no wonder. Inside, the small waiting room was empty, without a single piece of furniture. From an inner room, he heard a scuffle of feet and a head poked out from around a corner. A younger man with a salesman's smile.
"Hello. Hello, come in. Are you here about the ad?"
"I was looking for Dr. Cameron."
The smile froze and then melted away.
"Dr. Cameron's retired," he said. "Last week. He was the first tenant when the building was new, almost 50 years ago. And now he's retired."
He came forward and held out his hand. A dry, firm grip, and the smile was back in place.
I'm the landlord, Jeremy Bigelow. Don't suppose you might be in the market for office space. Great setup for almost any business. Waiting room, office, two rooms for storage or client meetings or whatever.
I suppose I could have a look while I'm here, Jack said, and followed along. The rooms had been scrubbed and painted, with only the vaguest smells left to indicate that this had been a medical practice. While Bigelow talked about square footage and foot traffic and the neighborhood, Jack looked out the window onto Christopher Street, wondering if Cameron had really retired or if he had gone into hiding. Bigelow wanted to know if he could show Jack anything else of interest.
Would you happen to have an address for Dr. Cameron?
Bigelow did not.
But his granddaughter is at the apothecary just across from the L station.
He jerked a thumb over his shoulder in the right direction.
Nora Smithson. She could help you, I'm sure.
On the street, Jack found Anna and Oscar waiting. Anna looking very grim, and Oscar irritated. Anna said, I have to get back to the New Amsterdam. If you come with me, we can talk in the cab. Traffic was just as congested as Jack expected it to be. But for once, it would work to their advantage. It took 10 minutes to get to the corner of West 9th, just enough time to share the bad news. Oscar said,
2 steps forward, 10 back.
Cameron had left the city only days before, on his way to Philadelphia, where he would be living with a nephew and his family. His offices had been vacated before Mamie Winthrop's operation and death.
No surgical instruments in Cameron's office? Anna asked Jack.
Cleaned out. Every bit of it. I looked into the closets and the water closet. No luck. What did Mrs. Sparrow have to tell you?
Cameron was the one who forced Amelie out of the city. He went to Comstock with stories of a mad abortionist who was killing women, and he named Amelie. There wasn't any evidence because... She looked at both of them intently. There wasn't any crime. But Comstock made her life impossible, and Nora Smithson started spreading rumors. Kate thinks that Cameron was mean to the bone but not murderous, and not capable of operating. His hands are palsied.
That's what his granddaughter said, that he hadn't had a patient in years. Kept the office out of stubbornness and pride.
Oscar didn't seem to be frustrated, but then he had been pursuing cases like this for years and had learned patience.
Does she have any medical training, the granddaughter?
Jack asked. Anna said, no schooling, but she was his nurse for years until she got married and moved over to the apothecary. They looked at each other for a few moments while the cab jerked to a stop and drivers let their displeasure be heard.
Now what?
Anna said, finally.
We go back to sorting through records and interviewing people,
Jack said.
And if there's another victim this week?
She asked.
Then we'll know for sure that Cameron wasn't involved, Oscar said. Or that he's still here, set up someplace else in the city and in hiding. Or that the responsible party has been tipped off,
Jack added. Anna asked,
he might just stop?
No,
Oscar and Jack said in one voice.
He's got an urge, Oscar said, whoever he is. He may go quiet for weeks or months, but he won't give up. Maybe he'll go away and start over, in Boston or Chicago. There's no way to know. But we do have another lead.
You're still thinking of Neil Graham as a suspect, Anna said.
Hard not to, Oscar said. You'd think so, too, if you heard him talking about operating on women. Things never tie up as neat as you'd like, Jack said, touching her arm. Or as fast. Nothing like surgery.
She gave him a lopsided grin. So I'm learning. Why don't you just take Graham in for questioning?
Because we haven't got any proof at all. And if we tip him off, he'll disappear.
That wouldn't do at all, Anna said. Not at all.
No reason to give up now, Oscar told her. Not when it's just getting interesting.
In the late evening, Jack forced himself to put aside thinking about the case so he could give in to the inevitable. He turned his mind to packing for the short trip to Greenwood. Anna's valise was already packed, and she had stretched out on the bed with one of her endless medical journals. Rumbling through the closet, he muttered to himself about the number of coats and vests and pairs of trousers he had accumulated. His sisters meant well, but had gotten into the habit of treating him like a mannequin, something that would hopefully stop now. Right at this moment, the problem was that he was not just going home tomorrow, but he was taking Anna home with him for the first time. That seemed to require something more than the casual clothes he normally put on to go to Greenwood. Anna had hung out a summer gown of many thin layers, overlapping in some places and pinned up in others. It was cut loose, like all her clothes, with a square neck that would show a great deal of bosom and her long neck. He was pulling a suit out of the wardrobe when there was a knock at the door.
"Sorry to bother you so late," Ned called, "but there's something you will want to hear."
Jack might have sent him away, but Anna pulled on her robe and tied it while she opened the door. "Is there something wrong?"
"No, but I talked to somebody who recognized Tonino from my description."
The story was quickly told. Ned had run into an old friend with the improbable name of Moby Dick.
"He apprenticed to a cobbler in Harlem 5 years ago or more. Hadn't seen him since he moved. He was down here to show his bride his old haunts."
Anna tried very hard to harness her impatience, but Jack did not. He made a twirling motion with his hand, and Ned wagged his head from side to side in acknowledgement.
"We were just talking, you know, and I mentioned I was looking for this Italian kid. Moby didn't know anything about him, but his girl did. She's a teacher at the deaf school. Hope, that's her name. Says they've got a little boy about 6 or 7 years old. Black hair, blue eyes, but he's deaf. So it's probably not the kid you're looking for, but I thought I'd mention it. If you want me to go up there and have a look, I can."
They were silent for a moment, and then she said, "I can't remember Tonino ever saying a word to me. Did you hear him talk, Jack?"
Jack had not. But if he were deaf, Rosa would have said something.
Children who have suffered a shock sometimes stop talking. They might believe he's deaf when he's just ignoring everything and everyone, out of self-preservation.
"Or he might be deaf," Jack said.
They looked at each other, and Jack saw something flash across her face, sudden insight or determination or both.
"We could go tomorrow, if we leave early enough."
Jack took a deep breath, and then another.
"That's what we'll have to do. But we can't say anything to the girls."
"Or Margaret," Anna agreed. "Or anyone. Another disappointment so soon would be very hard on the girls. Aunt Quinlan has a saying at times like this. Don't go looking for trouble. It will find you soon enough without you shouting out an invitation." Anna lay awake for a very long time, thinking of the very nature of trouble or bad luck or whatever name you wanted to use. More than that, she wondered why the idea of finding Tonino should strike her as trouble. In the end, she fell asleep thinking of Rosa, who wanted this brother back so very much. She had such high expectations of what it would mean to be reunited with him, when in fact, the boy she remembered was gone, even if they brought him home with them tomorrow.
Chapter 45. At 7, Jack went to hitch Bonnie to the Rockaway for the last-minute trip to the school for the deaf.
Anna followed, yawning into her palm. She had been determined to get a good night's sleep and had failed almost completely. In the stable, Bonnie nickered at Jack and presented her head for rubbing. Another female under his spell, Anna thought, and then watched as he snuck a lump of sugar out of his pocket and pressed the flat of his palm to her mouth.
"I saw that," he winked at her.
"Jealous?"
Anna made a face at him and went off in search of Mrs. Lee's coffee, walking through the garden. If she was really fortunate, the girls would be off with Margaret for what she called their morning constitutional. Otherwise, she would be overwhelmed with questions about her plans for the day, none of which she could answer honestly. With the door and windows all open, the smells that came from the kitchen reminded Anna of Thanksgiving. An odd thing for the last week of June. Mrs. Lee had been cooking and baking for days and had prepared so many things to take with them to Greenwood that Jack had arranged for his cousins to transport it all in one of the shop delivery wagons. Now Mrs. Lee was in a rush, putting the finishing touches on everything from a ham to an assortment of pies. Anna said,
"We don't have to bring enough food for the whole crowd, Mrs. Lee," and recognized her tactical error before the last word was out of her mouth.
Mrs. Lee lowered her chin to her breast to peer at Anna over the top of her spectacles, and delivered one of her lectures, short and to the point. She, Anna Savard, brought up in this very kitchen and reminded every day since she was 3 years old the importance of good manners, should realize that the Weeds and Roses folks could not call on the Mezzanotes empty-handed. While Anna listened, she poured herself a cup of coffee and milk and tried to look repentant. From her spot at the kitchen table, Aunt Quinlan said,
"Leave her be, Anna. You know she's not happy unless she's feeding people. And don't you look pretty. Where are you two off to this morning, anyway?"
"It's a secret," Mrs. Lee said. "Jack came by earlier to ask Henry could they take the rock away. Detective work."
Anna hooked a warm roll from a pan that had just come out of the oven and jumped back before Mrs. Lee could smack her hand.
"It's not a secret," she said, "but it's too complicated to explain just now."
"Is that so?"
Mrs. Lee's expression narrowed.
"I promise to tell all later," she said, and pressed an impromptu kiss on the old lady's cheek.
"Get on with you,"
Mrs. Lee flapped her hands, but she was smiling.
"I got work to do.
A calf to butcher. A last-minute 10-layer cake?"
"Anna," her aunt said, "if you can spare a few minutes. I had a letter from Sophie yesterday."
Anna sat down, her mood gone.
"I know how you're feeling," her aunt said. "It takes courage to open Sophie's letters. So let me just tell you. Cap is stable. That low-grade fever is still hanging on, but his spirits are good. He doesn't complain about food or even treatments, and sleeps a great deal.
And Sophie,
you know your cousin, she doesn't write about herself. Stories to tell about the folks in the village," Mrs. Lee interjected, "ignorant as they are."
Anna looked up in surprise, and her aunt explained.
"Sophie wrote about a little boy asking if he could see her tail. The ignorance of it," Mrs. Lee said. "She shouldn't have to contend with such meanness of spirit. She should be home here with us, where people know her worth and don't insult her asking can they see her tail. You would never let one of your children talk to a stranger like that, Lily, and you know it."
When Mrs. Lee called Aunt Quinlan by her first name, she had come to the end of her patience.
"I want her home," Mrs. Lee went on. "But to get her here, we got to lose Cap. I'm always wanted to ask you, Anna, will Sophie be home by the end of the summer? But I stop myself. It would be like asking, when will it be that Cap passes over?"
Anna had to swallow very hard to find her voice. She went of her own free will, Mrs. Lee. She went gladly because she wants and needs to be with Cap. No doubt it is odd and sometimes uncomfortable for her, but Sophie won't let anything get in the way of caring for him. You know that. If it makes you feel better, sit down and write her a letter and say what you're thinking.
I'ma do just that, Mrs. Lee said, first thing we get home.
And now I have to go. I'll see you all at Greenwood.
Her voice came a little hoarse.
What about your satchels?
Her aunt asked. On the back porch. Ned will fetch them when the wagon comes.
She glanced around the kitchen, but bit back a smile.
For all this.
You won't be late.
As close as her aunt came to issuing a command.
Of course not. We'll be there in the late afternoon.
Late afternoon?
Mrs. Lee shook her head.
Where are you going to eat between now and then? One of them little cafes where they serve out stomachache as a first and last course? Is that how you look after your husband?
I swear.
While she talked, she grabbed up things and stuffed them into a marketing basket. Then she thrust it at Anna.
Lunch.
Anna was still smiling to herself when she got back to the stable and found that they were set to leave, Bonnie stomping to announce she was eager to be on the road. Jack's face was already damp with sweat, but he looked pleased with himself.
There's Ned, Mr. Lee said, pointing with his chin. He's unsure about coming along today, just so you know.
Mr. Lee had decided that Ned belonged here. That was obvious to Anna. She wondered if Ned realized as much. Jack called out in Italian, his tone easy, but Ned's face contorted in mock terror.
Didn't do it, he called back. Wasn't me.
Coming up to him, Anna gave him a gentle push.
Stop pretending to be an outlaw.
I think I'm insulted,
Ned said, rubbing his shoulder. Jack said,
What else do you know about Moby Dick's wife?
Ned's look of surprise was genuine.
Well, let's see. She's from an old Dutch family in Harlem. Don't remember her maiden name. You headed up to talk to her.
Maybe, Jack said. She goes by Hope March. Mrs. March?
That would be Moby's moniker when he's plying his trade. Richard March.
And she teaches at the school for the deaf. You're sure of it?
She teaches knitting and sewing and such to the girls.
Anna said to Jack, Stop interrogating him. And to Ned, Do you happen to remember anything else about the boy she mentioned to you, beyond his hair and eye color?
Ned glanced down at the ground, scuffed the cobblestones with his heel, hesitating.
Spit it out. Jack said. Whatever it is.
He shrugged.
She said the kid was simple, you know? Slow. Like a lot of deaf kids, his brains got scrambled somewhere along the way. But she wasn't mean about it. Moby always was a soft-hearted mope. They suit each other that way.
There's more than one soft-hearted mope in this story, Anna said.
What if it is him?
Ned wanted to know.
We'll bring him home, Anna said. And your friend's wife will get a reward. But Ned, don't say a word to anybody, especially not the girls.
Now he looked insulted. I wouldn't hurt those girls for the world.
Anna touched his shoulder.
We know that. Are you coming to Greenwood with us?
Jack had started to turn away, but he stopped to glance at Ned.
You're invited, in case you need reminding.
Do your sisters know that?
Ned asked him.
Jack grinned.
I guess we'll find out.
Traffic was light so early on a Sunday morning, which was a very good thing, considering how far they had to go. The New York School for the Deaf and Dumb was well out of the city at 165th Street, an hour and a half away in good traffic.
Alone, she would have had to take at least 2 trains, with long waits in between connections. She leaned back and felt herself relaxing. For the next little time, they had nothing to worry about, and only themselves to amuse. She said,
"You are a useful creature."
Jack gave her a long, thoughtful glance.
"Am I supposed to return the compliment, or will that irritate you?"
"You know how useful I am," she said. "I can't really cook,
at least not the way I'd need to cook to keep you fed. I don't clean, I barely sew. I've never done a full load of laundry."
"I can't do any of those things either."
"But you can hitch a wagon, and clean a gun, and repair a broken window. You mended the strap on my shoe, built a coat rack for the front hall. I believe you could have done most of the work on the house yourself with sufficient time. You negotiated the purchase, too."
"No, unless you need surgery or dosing, I'm very much useless. There's a term in German that suits me exactly. I'm a Fachidiot. I know a huge amount about one thing, and I'm idiotically uninformed about everything else. It's a good thing we have household help, or you'd be going to work hungry in wrinkled clothes."
"We've had this discussion before," Jack said, "and we can keep having it until you believe that I like what I've got and I'm not going anywhere. Your brother was a boy in a bad situation and he let you down. That's not me, and you know it."
"Not everything is about my brother," she said a little huffily. He glanced at her, his expression cool.
"Not everything," he said finally. "But this is. Stop trying to talk me into giving up on you. It won't work."
Anna wanted to protest, but she remembered quite suddenly a conversation with her aunt, and not so very long ago. She had predicted exactly this, that Anna would try to isolate herself from Jack. The thought struck her with almost palpable force, and it took a few minutes for her to regain her composure. For the first time, she had the idea that with Jack's help, she might someday come to understand the boy her brother had been and to forgive the decisions he had made.
"You're right," she said finally. "I've been testing you without even realizing it. I apologize."
He glanced at her, his expression guarded at first. Then he smiled and took her hand, raised it to his mouth, and kissed her knuckles.
"You know," he said, "we don't have to go to the school today. It's waited this long. How about a picnic in Central Park instead? We could let Bonnie stretch her legs and then go sit by one of the lakes."
It did sound like a very good idea, and she said so.
"But I think we have to do it today, Jack. It would be a week or more before we get another chance."
He asked her about the school for the deaf, and Anna told him the little she knew. "They have an excellent reputation. I've never had a patient from there, but Sophie has, and she liked the place. The children are well looked after, and there were no signs of abuse."
"You think a lot about the welfare of children."
Anna's head came around quite quickly.
"Does that surprise you, given the work I do?"
"Not in the least. I'm going to ask you something, and I don't want you to get mad."
"Not a very hopeful start," she said, but she produced a single dimple, which he took as encouragement.
"I'm wondering if there are many women who would rather not have children, if they had a choice."
"Are you asking about me?"
He shook his head. "I've been thinking about Janine Campbell and the others."
Her gaze shifted and lost its focus. She was letting her mind lead her, following whatever images and words and ideas it presented, many of them beyond his understanding. She said,
"Really, you want to know if women are mentally destined to become mothers? I think the answer is no.